What are you guys selling?
You're drowning and I throw you a life jacket. Would you grab it? Yes. Good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down.
Pay that man his money.
Ask them how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they going to say? No? I don't want to see those returns?
Where's the money, Lebowski?
You're going to make a lot of money, right?
Be aggressive. Learn how to push.
Show them a 3% return, and I'll trust you to watch his kids for the weekend.
I'm a big fan of money.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I did not know this.
That's it. I'm done.
Lone Wolf Bank, Sykes & Jackson. I'm Tamar Rickey on the board. SP Futures down 4, NASDAQ Futures down 29. A little bit of a slide here. We had some earnings last night. We'll tell you about in a minute. We have a Professor Lou. Mentioned to him that motion creates emotion. To Lou.
Good morning.
How are you?
Oh, well, I'm motionless, so I'm apparently emotionless.
You're never motionless. You're always on the go, doing some legal stuff.
Well, you know, I do. This is terrible. You know, I thought 20 years ago, I thought I'd be well and goodly retired by now, but I'm still cranking away and enjoying it. But it does cause me to wake up in the middle of the night thinking about, you know, issues and stuff like that that's rolling out in my cases. So for those of you who are listening who are not approaching your 3-score year and 10, if you continue working, you will find that the same problems you had when you were 30 affect you when you're 70.
Since when do people ever think people change?
I don't know. I find it interesting that even though I'm supposedly experienced, I have the same concerns that I had when I was inexperienced.
That's because the world hasn't changed much. I was with an attorney last night who just unfortunately lost a case. And he's 83, and I think he goes to work the same as he did when he was 30. That's the weirdest part when you're young and you look at people that are older and you figure how they must think. They think just like you. They think just like you do.
in many ways, yes. Although
some ways, no. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've noticed, and I have a relative who's in her 90s. And you notice, you know, certain things about older people. If you ever take a cruise on one of the lines that specialize in having no children, for example, you end up with an older population, typically in their mid to late 70s. And it's, you know, when you get in with a bunch of people like that, certain trends become apparent. And it's just interesting. It's just interesting to watch, you know, and people talk about what they know and about what's common to them, but you know, there's a fixation on illness.
Well,
and fixation
yeah.
on doctors, and a fixation on, you know, whatever health things. And I mean, it.
Well, you're not going to talk about the basketball game last night. You didn't play basketball last night.
That's right. And so it's interesting, you know, and you know, just watching the sort of the mental, I won't say the word that I'm looking for is the mental changes that happen to people as they get older. I mean, in terms of their ability to pick up new information when confronted with new situations, how they react, all of this. And I mean, I'm guilty of it myself, obviously.
Are you one of those that at any age you were 10 years older was old?
No, I don't think so.
When you were 20, 30 was old, and you're 30, 40 was old.
No, I've always had the cutoff for me. And when I had kids, you know, the mortality, your sense of mortality really takes a jump when you have children, because now you've got a yardstick sitting right in front of you, you know, reminding you of what it used to be like.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, looking at yourself and saying, "Yeah, I can't do that anymore." So I've always had an idea that, you know, as I said, when I had kids, I started thinking, you know, middle age really isn't your 50s. I used to think middle age was, you know, your 50s or so. No, middle age is like your late 30s, early 40s, and you realize, yeah, in another another lifetime. I've lived this lifetime so far, and in another lifetime like that, if I'm not dead, I'm gonna be, you know, looking at it. And so, no, I've always looked at old as, you know, 60 plus, and that's been the age that you sort of think, okay, things should be changing.
Well, one of the guys I was at the softball picnic a few weeks ago, and he was playing in an over 75 league. And he was doing fine. Himself in shape, and, you know, whatever.
That's right. And something that's really sort of interesting is that, you know, when you and I were in our 30s or 20s, you know, 65 was older. And you know, guys living much past their middle 70s were old, really old.
Yeah.
Now that I'm there, you know, healthcare and the science of exercise and physiology has developed to such an extent that it's remarkable what people in their seventh decade are capable of doing. And the other thing that's remarkable is how much genetics factors into this.
You can't be doing good in your 70s if you don't make it.
Well, and also just how you age. I mean, I have people, you know, friends that I know, classmates, who have aged much, much more rapidly than others, and they look older now. Whether they're acting older, I don't know, but I've got classmates who are jumping out of airplanes still, who are, I mean, one of them just came back from some scuba diving trip in in Okinawa, going down 100 feet swimming around. I mean, these were things, you know, the 70s were referred to as your golden years, when you're supposed to be sitting on the porch in the rocking chair, you know, laughing at your grandchildren. What I see when I go to the gym, what I see at the gym is a bunch of old guys who are pumping iron and you know, banging it out on the Nordic track or the rowing machine, and really that standard, the bar, I think, has been raised for what we expect out of physical vitality in people that age.
Well, when I was young, people who, most of the males, I mean, the only one who was an absolute outlier was my grandfather, of all people. I don't know where he picked it up, but he was a master boiler maker. But most, everybody I knew, even looking back at it now, because I remember this stuff, I have a pretty good memory, and everybody kind of worked hard during the day. I don't know of anybody's dad, and I'm talking about, we were, you know, 12 years old, so the dads are 35, maybe 40, and at most. And I don't know of anybody's dad who had a bike. We even had a pair of athletic shoes. They weren't like they were in bad shape, and they worked hard all day. They all smoked incessantly. They weren't huge boozers, but everybody drank. But mostly everybody smoked, and nobody did. They weren't heavy, but they're a lot lighter than the people are now. I mean, now everybody, you know, anybody who was 240 in those age was like a professional football player. Now everybody's waddling around 240, it seems. But I don't know of any of those guys that ever did any kind of exercise at all. And I was, we went to a, I don't know if I told you this, I went to a funeral out in Marengo, of all places. A friend of Audrey's been trading floor, and she knew this guy's mom real well. Anyway, but I knew the guy pretty well, too, but I never met the mom. So we go out there, and the mom dies at, like, 90-something. And the funeral is at this, it's at the cemetery. There's no funeral home, and I'm thinking, it's kind of odd. But good thing it didn't rain. We're waiting, all of a sudden the hearse pulls up. We had probably 20 minutes we were waiting, and me, being my inquisitive self, now that I'm Stocks and Jacks, just wandering around, and I'm looking at the headstones. You might say, why the hell? And virtually everybody had some kind of a, what do you put on there to show you were in World War II or Korea?
Yeah, a flag.
A flag or something.
Were they U.S. government headstones? Were they the white?
They showed they were in the, versus whole section, people had been in the Army, which in small towns, pretty much everybody was in the Army, right, in World War II and so forth, unless you were in a factory. So, but I'm looking at the dates, and every one of them, 57, 58, 55, yeah. Once in a while you'd see a 68, And then we went, you know, we had the reception at the house, and all the local people, every single one of them, nobody came in the house, because outside there's like three tables of 10 people, everybody smoking. And I could just see, you go, you fight a war, you come back, and they're pouring cigarettes at you over there. I mean, this is not an anti-cigarette show here, but I'm saying they live the same way now as they probably did back then. Everybody came back, you might have had some battle fatigue, you know, now what, whatever the post-traumatic stress, whatever they want to call it. I mean, once in a while, very rarely did you see like a 70. And then I get a load of this. Across the street, there's this little cemetery, and all this, these headstones are falling apart. It's like next to somebody's house. And I'm going, what in God's name is that? And then, of course, I put two and two together. We had driven over a railroad track to get to the cemetery. And I'm thinking, that has to be the Chicago to the Galena Railroad. That was the first railroad out of Chicago in the 1840s or something. Because Galena had, I'm thinking, those got to be the guys that worked on the railroad. And that's why they've been there 120, God, how many years would that be? 140 years, no wonder the headstones are falling apart. It has to be the railroad guys. It was the railroad cemetery. I mean, you go back, you just look at this stuff. If you want to look around you, you can find an amazing amount of history, can't you? If you just keep your eyes open.
So, couple of things. My mother's family goes way back, like, you know, Declaration of Independence signers way back.
Really?
In the East Tennessee and that area. And having gone to some of the family cemeteries there, and seeing headstones from the 1700s,
wow,
and the early 1800s, and looking at well, the first thing you notice, number one, a huge number of children, you know, died in, you know, first 5 years of life, huge number of child headstones, you know, buried next to the mothers, buried next to fathers, whatever. The second thing is, as you noted, a significant number of people dying in their 40s and 50s. It's very much, and again, this is our mark of progress. I mean, our healthcare has gotten infinitely better than it was in the late 1700s, early 1800s. But it seemed like there was a spike. You know, you again, if you weren't genetically,
oh, when the invention prepped, of penicillin had to get it 10 years nationwide.
Oh yeah. Antibiotics, sanitation, Tom.
Yeah,
just basic sanitation. But it, if your genetics were good, you got past the first, you know, 10 years of life, getting exposed to measles, chickenpox, whatever, mumps, that didn't kill you. So you came out of that, smallpox. You came out of that.
You didn't come out of smallpox.
Pardon me?
You didn't come out of smallpox.
Well, smallpox, you know, the smallpox kills, I think, about 30% of the people that get it if you contract it and untreated.
When did that? That was about 1870. They figured that out, right?
Jenner, right? Edward Jenner?
Well, they actually had people actually see it on some of the old westerns where you could actually. The interesting thing about smallpox, this is weird, but I was reading this up because I'm trying to figure out if there still is any left in the world. You can actually take the, I'll use the term vaccine, it's not really a vaccine, for smallpox after you get it, and in a couple of days it'll still work. So what they used to do is if the town contracted smallpox, they would go find milkmaids.
Yes,
that had cowpox, and actually would take it, you know, they had whatever, the big pimples, whatever you want to call them, you could actually take the live pus out of them and stick it in somebody else's skin, and it worked. So they would do it live for a while before they could actually store it. But they actually would have live transfer was the first part of the disease.
Yeah, I think it was Edward Jenner. Anyway, the British physician who
he might have been the guy who decided how you could get it from one person to the next without actually having a live donor.
Well, he was the one who basically did a systematic study of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it had been known that cowpox exposure acted as a preventative, and so he formalized it, put two and two together, and said, okay, these are similar, genetically similar, and this is why this works. But in any event, if you were genetically sound or sounder, and you got past that spike, you were of mortality. You had a reasonably good chance of making it into your 40s and 50s, and then again, it was another matter of genetics. But I look at how, you know, somebody who's, if you were to take a bunch of my, for example, my Air Force Academy classmates, and put them in a,
but those, you know, guys got to be on the top of the gene pool to start with.
Well, but you know,
athletically anyway,
some of them look. I mean, most of them are in reasonably good shape, but some of them look great. Some of them look like they've, you know, been exposed to plutonium. Most of them are really fit, but it's a really interesting sort of marker of, you had good genes, you know, you didn't. You're totally bald at 70, but your hair's falling, you know, almost gone at 70. You've got a full head of hair, and, you know, one guy I got one of my classmates whose hair has barely gone hardly gray at all. He looks like he's in his 50s. And
maybe, I mean, maybe he's got some stuff going.
Could be. I mean, but, you know, I had a conversation with him. I said, okay, you know, I'm not going to tell anybody you're dyeing your hair. And he goes, I'm not dyeing my hair. He goes, that's what's so weird about this. He said, I fully expected to be totally gray by now. He goes, I haven't lost my hair, and I'm not doing anything to it. It's just, this is the way it looks.
Wow.
So it's really, again, it's this remarkable genetic diversity that, one, allows us to survive, because with that kind of genetic diversity, I guarantee you the guys that look that, you know, have looked like they've aged faster have some other positive genetic factor going in their favor, that if some biological catastrophe comes and overtakes us, maybe they survive because of that genetic element.
Well, I think you wonder, someday somebody's going to do a study that, you know, it's kind of weird, is because, well, everybody has some sort of tethys issue, right? But I wonder the fact that people had really awful oral health. When I say that, what happens is, I had a dentist who, years and years ago, he ended up leaving the dentistry, well, not really leaving it, and become a professor at some big school or something.
Like the ministry? He left the dentistry?
Well, yeah, he later became... But he was saying that what happens with oral health, and this is... we'll talk about other stuff, but he said there's some infections in your body that cause people real problems over time. And he said there's certain ones where your body fights infection, right? You know, white blood cells, you know, all this kind of stuff. I'm not a doctor, but he said there's some where the body just says okay and just gives up, and it's there. And he says one of those essentially is gum disease. He says it's an infection, and, you know, most people, he goes, either depending on the pH in your mouth, either you have bad teeth or you have bad gums. It's very rare for somebody to have really good both, because depending on the pH, it either works against your teeth or works against your gums. I, for one, have always had great teeth, and had gum issues, and as soon as I started getting cleaned every 3 months, I haven't had a gum issue in 40 years. But before that, you know, when you went every 6 months, he said, what happens is your body fights it for a while, and then just kind of stops fighting it. He says, so it's actually very insidious, and he named a couple other things that are like that, some other kinds of little infections or inflammations. He says, if you don't take care of those, they can start messing with the body big time. So I wonder, even what, like, oral health and people just pulling teeth and stuff, I wonder how much that affected people's, without even knowing about it, I wonder how much that affected people's longevity. They always had some infection going in you.
I mean, you know, a tooth infection will kill you.
Yeah.
If you don't take care of it. Like, you know, certain other ones. Yeah, I know. It's always amazed me, though, the pace at which we age, the pace at which our physical and mental deterioration overtakes us, and as I said, we go on occasional the occasional cruise where there are no kids allowed, and as I said, an older population, and the variance in people who are, over 60 is astounding. And that was one of the things that COVID revealed. COVID, when that disease, broke out, one of the things that it did was a kind of a culling of the herd. If you had a pre-existing condition, or you had
diabetes was real bad.
If you had a pre-existing condition, or you had a genetic, some kind of issue with your blood system, your circulatory system, that disease targeted you, and you were in real danger. I track my classes activities for our graduate association, and I get the death notices for my classmates, and we had a huge spike in 2021 with people passing, not necessarily from quote COVID unquote, but certainly that disease. If you were genetically or had a condition that had developed, earlier, that disease marked you.
Yeah.
And it definitely had an impact on that. I have not seen a reliable excess mortality number for those years, but I wonder if they could, if they're,
what's weird. We've talked about it.
I was going to say, let me just finish the sentence. Yeah. That they could mark an effect on Social Security benefits. In other words, we stopped paying out as much Social Security.
Actually,
lost so many people.
Carl, we went through and probably will again, now that you mentioned it. Carl has all those numbers. And the weird part of it is, Lou, is the year after was worse than the COVID year. Which makes you wonder.
I don't doubt that. It was, and we've had this discussion, but it was very apparent. It probably in by May of 2020, that the preventative measures we were taking were going to kill more people, at least reduce the number of so-called life hours, because the people that were dying from our preventative measures were younger than the people that were dying from the disease, but it was going to reduce the number of life hours of the population in more. The preventative measures were going to do that and have a greater impact on that than the actual disease was. I just wonder if we have any accurate numbers about excess deaths for people who were Social Security and Medicare eligible.
I think
that had a bump on our financial and fiscal picture.
Those numbers are all screwed up because of the idea, it's funny how people do stuff. And, it's funny, the training... in some ways, I think your training and my training in grad school are somewhat the same. And maybe any kind of real training should be that way. Is you always sit there and say, whatever you do, you probably know this, who was the Chinese or Japanese philosopher said, no man can do just one thing?
Yes.
And I forget who the only guy's name was. But I mean, in my world, in grad school, I was taught pretty stringently by these guys at the University of Chicago. I don't know if they teach it now. Every exam, especially in the economics world, not so much in the business world, was this is a policy change. Work it through stock and flow analysis for the next 10 years. What effects is it going to have on everything else? And that was just what we had to learn to do. And I'm sure in your business, being the Air Force Academy, okay, if we do this, if we make the plane go faster, but oh, by the way, drop some of the fuel tanks in the meantime, what does it mean? Well, we can't go as far. I mean, there's a reaction to everything you do, right?
And the essence of public policy is not only anticipating those reactions as a result of a policy change, finding new ones, and then extrapolating to the costs, so that you understand what a cost, you get a picture of cost benefit analysis, which, as far as I know, was never done for COVID.
Well, right, and I think what I was getting to is when they decided to pay hospitals a 20% bonus or whatever it was for people who died from COVID, all it did was totally blow your COVID observations off the wall. Not to mention the fact that your COVID, your hotbeds of COVID, and I guess I sort of know this, I caught COVID at a hospital with a mask on. I went there for a test. And that's the only place I was for that week and a half. I didn't go anywhere else. Unless I caught it, you know, through my front door being open to get the mail, it's the only place I was. And I know of several people who were in the hospital, you know, on death's door, and while they were there, they caught COVID, and they had COVID when they died. But that's not why they died, right? One of my attorney buddies, played football for Michigan, says one of his buddies had been fighting prostate cancer forever. Finally, it got down to the last few days, and he's in this hospital, and he gets COVID, and they said he died from COVID. He goes, the guy had nothing to do with the COVID. And I know a young lady, a friend, who her dad was in the hospital, had been in and out, and the guy's 94 or something. Everything wrong with him. Finally, he dies. And then they decide, well, he had COVID. And I said, her name's Kathy. I said, Kathy, you know, they're paying out funeral expenses for people that have COVID. She goes, but he didn't die from COVID. I said, yeah, they got it on the death certificate. What are you doing? And then she got like $8,000 or $5,000 or something.
No, but I think it was $9,000.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
For payout. It, if you go in, and this is, you know that I litigated some of these COVID vaccine cases. And one of the things that we delved into when we were litigating this stuff and trying to establish exactly what was the benefit of a mandatory vaccine policy and mandating it as an employer and how it all rolled out. One of the things that jumps out at you when you do that kind of analysis is how totally random the governments or the CDC's and the NIH's assessments and recommendations were, and how ridiculous the incentives were that they were providing for people to report that they had COVID or had died from it. And we realized early on that what was happening was that from the CDC's perspective, the more people that you could get showing death from COVID, the better their budget chances were.
Oh, God, yeah.
The more important they became, the more status they were garnering, because this was looking like a horrific pandemic, when in fact the impact was quite limited. We were looking at with the military vaccination program was where I was focusing a lot of my efforts for obvious reasons. And one of the things that jumped out at us was there was absolutely no need to vaccinate the U.S. military. None. For the cohort that was just subject to the vaccination order, the COVID infection was basically the flu. And so why were we injecting an experimental unlicensed substance into forcing people to take an injection with this stuff when there was no logical basis? And yet, again, because of the bureaucratic interests that were in place, you were getting the recommendation to take the shot because this expanded CDC's empire.
Well, I have
it's fascinating to watch this and see this all play out. If you read Scott Atlas's book about his time at the White House when Trump brought him in as an outsider to give him an outside look at what was happening with the vaccination program and the pandemic efforts, the first thing he does when he gets into a meeting with Fauci and the rest of them is to say, where's the cost? He's a public health policy guy. He said, where's the cost-benefit analysis for the shutdowns and the vaccination programs that you're ordering versus doing nothing? So we have a benchmark for what doing nothing does versus what you guys are doing. And they said, we don't have one. He goes, then how do you know you're not doing more damage than you're helping?
Well,
this is the most basic elements of a public health response, and these guys blew it off.
I look back at that, Lou, it's the thing that I don't know, if I had to really criticize people, and it's hard when you're making these kinds of decisions, it's hard if you're not there, it's hard to criticize, but I will say several things about this, and it's just one man's observation, is as much as you might want to panic when it first happened, you know, let's vaccinate everybody in nursing homes. I mean, that I don't think was a problem. But the idea of even shutting stuff down, and the weird part is there was never any respect, since I was one of them, there was never any respect for people that had already had the disease.
Yes.
And had their own... I'll use an example of our dear friend that was a producer of the show forever, and maybe one day we'll see him again, Mr. Matt Weber. Matty and his lovely bride, Jill, they both get the COVID early. He, like, you know, a lot of people didn't even really know he had it. He got a test because Jill was sick.
Yeah, and Matt was at the time, what, in his early 40s?
Oh, God, no, 30s. They didn't have any kids yet. He might have been 30. So Jill has a problem for a few days, and she's fine. So Matty shakes it off, and he said he never would have not gone and played basketball if he didn't know he had it, by taking a test because she had it. 3 weeks later, he says, yeah, I got my COVID shot. I go, you did what? He goes, I got my COVID shot. And as they wanted me to get it for, like, work, I said, Matt, you already had the disease. You're developing your own antibodies. I'm no research guy, but at least I know this much. The shot's going to basically bleep you up in the midst of you making your own antibodies. Oh, that's fine. Well, sure enough, 3 months later, he gets it again. He's sick as a dog for a week. I mean, the idea that you were forcing shots on people that already had it. Plus, I had it early, and I went to see if I had the antibodies. My doctor goes, yeah, they are blinking away. You're fine. You're not going to get it again for like a year or whatever. You know, you never can get it again. And here I am walking around wearing a mask. I can't go into a restaurant. I couldn't. I would happily helped out in a nursing home if I was able to get in, but they wouldn't let me in, you know, because the fact that I had it and I had antibodies, I didn't need any shots. My doctor was smart enough to say, okay, you can go get a shot, but not for a minimum of 6 months. He said, then it probably is not going to hurt you, and it might actually help you. But so I didn't. But I mean, the idea that we didn't. It became so political, Lou, so political.
Well, yeah, and I hold it up as an example of, you know, the classic example of big government bureaucratic infighting and influence peddling, and we so this is how bad it got. There's a law on the books that's unlike civilians. There's a law on the books that says you can't force military members to get a vaccine with an unlicensed vaccine without their informed consent. You can't order them to do it. There are circumstances where you can order them. The president has to sign a waiver. You have to do some other stuff. But as a general rule, if you don't have a licensed, fully licensed FDA vaccine or FDA-approved vaccine, you can't order these people to get the shot. So FDA, but there was a lot of pressure in the summer of 21 for Biden to order the military to get the vaccine because they wanted a national vaccination program because CDC was pushing it. And people were going, well, wait a minute, I don't want to get the shot. If it's such a big deal, if you want people to take the vaccine, why isn't the military taking it? Because you can order them to take it. And so there was a lot of pressure developing on getting the military to get this shot done, even though the vaccine was not licensed. So the FDA in August of 21 licenses a vaccine called Comirnaty. Have you ever heard of Comirnaty?
No.
Yeah. So this is unprecedented.
This is the COVID vaccine?
Pardon me?
It's a COVID vaccine?
Yes, it is. It's the first licensed COVID vaccine.
But it wasn't one. Well, that's the one from Europe? Because there was the seven they gave all the money to.
It was developed in Europe. It was developed at the Pfizer lab in Europe, but it was called Comirnaty.
But okay, it was from Pfizer essentially was behind it.
Yeah. But it was licensed. That was the name of the vaccine, but you haven't heard of it.
No.
And here's why. The vaccine gets licensed on like August 21. On August 20, or that afternoon, after FDA issues its licensing letter, they simultaneously withdraw the marketing approval for Comirnaty in the United States. the next day, the military says, we've got a licensed vaccine. We're ordering all of you to get vaccinated. And the Biden people trumpet this and say, see, all of you should go out and get the shot, and we're going to...
Was this Biden or Trump? Because it kind of all this happened while they were transferring over.
This was Joe Biden. Okay. He'd been in office since the January 20 of 21. This was all Biden. See, we've got a licensed vaccine, so we're going forward. None of the vaccine that was put into service members was licensed, but they were ordered to take the shot anyway, because it was important for the Biden people to be able to say, we have a licensed vaccine, see, we're making the military take it, you should take it too, and oh, employers, we're encouraging you now to go out and force people to take the shot.
I'm certainly not going to debate whether it was Biden or not, but under the, and this is not a criticism, it's just saying how things have a momentum.
Oh yeah.
Once Trump gave all those, and I agree with its time, he gave all the companies seven companies were in the hunt.
Yep.
I think three of them came out of it. I still remember reading the deal, Bill, because you and I did the show on it.
Yes, we did.
They gave, for those just as history of this, they gave the seven companies essentially money up front as they were working on all these different seven different vaccines.
Operation Warp Speed.
Yeah, and they said, okay, we're going to, if you're putting all your research money in, we're going to buy, I'm thinking the numbers now off the top of my head, we're going to buy like 7 million vaccines right now, and we're going to give you like $20 a pop for the vaccines.
Yeah,
if you want our money for the research, we'll give you like, whatever, 50 million for the research, but now we're only going to pay 10 for the vaccines. It actually made some sense. But I don't think, if Trump would have won after he did that and trumpeted the fact that he did it, the first one he could have given somebody, he'd have done the same thing.
You're not going to get any arguments from me.
Yeah, because what did your buddy Bill Kennedy say? Events were in the saddle and they drove the men hard?
Yeah, at that time, and Trump was not in a position, because of the way Fauci and the rest of these people were doing this, Trump was not in a position to argue with it.
Yeah, how could
you had this government agency that was set up specifically to deal with something like this.
And you already gave everybody all his money.
And you said, okay, we're going to get the vaccine rolled out. CDC was engaged in full-scale empire building, and this was all rolling forward.
Okay, but just for everybody to listen, when Lou said the next day, the reason for this giving everybody money is if it was approved on a Friday, they wanted seven companies to have 4 million doses ready on a Saturday, right? That's what they paid for. So what you said, the next day they started doing it, this is why they could do it, right?
Yes, yeah. So FDA issues a license for this vaccine and then withdraws the marketing for it simultaneously. So there is no licensed vaccine in the United States. But FDA could say, we have a licensed vaccine. And that's what the administration did. And so this...
Why are they still pushing people to get this, even at a young age?
I don't know. I had a conversation because this is, you know, it became, as you noted, it became a loyalty test. Are you with the program?
It became a test to go to work.
It became a loyalty test, a political loyalty test before that. Are you supporting this program? You know, are you on board with this? And you know, if you're on board with this, and you know, you'll get the shot, you'll wear a mask. That was another test.
You know, thing was, is that it wasn't. I want to ask you about these blasting more ships in the Pacific, but ships, boats. The weird part of all this, and you mentioned the politics of it, which of course I'm not going to disagree with you because it was. But you know, I listened to I remembered vividly. I'm driving home from the South Side on a Sunday, and Pritzker, for whatever reason, was having. All these people were having like news conferences every day. Remember how?
Yep.
And he was. It wasn't like he was getting pushed by Trump or Biden or anything. For whatever reason, he's standing up in front of these reporters, and a couple of they were happening to ladies. It's not a sexist.
By the way, old JB was in one of the primary risk groups for that disease.
Well, yeah, but so he's standing there, and he's getting he is getting annihilated by these people, because the governor of somewhere, Michigan or some damn place, had just authorized like the second shutdown. Remember, they had the first one, and it started to free up, and there was a second one. I think it was the second one. This babe is on him like white on rice. What do you mean you're not going to do it? You don't care enough about people as the governor of Michigan or the governor of this place? He goes, I've read all this stuff. I don't think it's needed right now. Things are getting better. People use their head, and if they have it, they stay in their house. Because we don't need to do this. They were on him like they were accusing him of being Satan and wanting to kill people. As soon as the news conference ended, I go, Lou had been sitting there. I said, my buddy Lou, I'll bet you $100. He does it tomorrow. And sure enough, he did. At that point, it had nothing to do with science.
It became a religion.
I mean, I felt such an idiot wearing this mask. Plus, guys in the local bar are giving me grief about the mask. The idea that you would walk in with a mask, sit down at a table, and while you're closest with everybody, you could take the mask off while you ate. Then when you had to put the mask back on to go to the can.
It was the most ridiculous, stupid, and people bought it. And this was the point that we were making in this litigation. We were saying it's ridiculous to inoculate, especially with an unlicensed vaccine, which is illegal. It's ridiculous to inoculate people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s with this stuff, because that's not the mortality rates.
Yeah.
And that's why I said I don't know if we'll ever get an accurate number, but the mortality rates were like zero for those folks.
One of your legal buddies sitting at the bar in a Tripoli, before they closed them down, or whatever, somewhere along the line, maybe after they opened up, you had to wear masks. And he's wearing one of those ones like they wore in the Western movies to go rob the stagecoach, you know, the bandana.
Yeah.
And I go, guy's name's Luke. I go, Luke, what are you doing? What are you doing wearing that thing? He's like, what are you talking about? You're supposed to wear a mask. Don't you care about other people? Luke, that thing isn't worth. If you needed to wear a mask, what would you do if your surgeon walked in wearing that thing? You'd say, get me out of this operating room. I said, by the way, how often do you wash that thing? 3 times a day? He goes, I haven't washed it yet. I go, duh.
Hello.
But hey, we're talking about page 2, Paul Harvey. You talked last week about actually giving courses and when you can do military action and when you're not. And by the way, I was very appreciative of that because I learned some stuff. Why, if some of this stuff is made sense of, somewhere along the line, don't you have to produce some evidence? And why would you ever say, I think if it was me and you were my advisor or you were there and I was trying to advise you, I would say, all right, we don't really want drugs coming in here. I get that part. Venezuela, it appears, supplies a lot of the cocaine. They don't seem to be in the fentanyl loop. Why would you not say we're going to have the Coast Guard interdict these boats? If they refuse to stop, you know, we're going to use force to make them stop, and we're going to produce the evidence. Why would you ever say, I ordered these guys to just, like, kill these guys? What would possess anybody to do that, and where do you get the power to do that? I mean, he basically said on TV that I authorized him to use deadly force, and basically I know the stuff's on the boats. I don't care about the evidence. How does anybody even think of that? I mean, I don't care who it is, Democrat, Republican, or whatever. How does anybody do that?
First of all, you're subject to the somewhat inarticulate statements of the president, who is just speaking off the cuff and saying what pops into his head, and he's shortcutting a few steps there. He's been presented with evidence. We think. Well, I'm almost 100% sure that he has. I mean, I can't. Can I say it with absolute, you know, certainty? I'm not in the room, so no. But you don't take action like this. I mean, the precedents for doing stuff like this have been long established. There are specific things that you look for that will turn something like this into a from a law enforcement issue to a defense Department of War issue. And my understanding, based on not just what I've read from, you know, administration sources, but from what I've read from, you know, Venezuelan sources, is that the efforts to that we're looking at a grand strategy issue here, where we are looking at attempts by foreign powers, China, others, to destabilize the United States and to make it more difficult for us to operate as an international actor in the world.
All right, Lou, I don't want to be a self-flagellant on this. Why is it for years and years, if you got shot anywhere in the world, it was a 90% chance you got shot with an American bullet? Why don't these same rules apply?
That's not accurate.
I'm talking about, I said years ago, before all these other guys invented the AK-47. I'm talking about traditionally.
Like the 1960s?
I'm saying for a long time. I don't want to get off the subject. I want to stick to the subject you're on, but I'm saying the idea that we sell guns to people in places where they're shooting people doesn't make us a destabilizer in our mind.
That's a whole different argument.
I know.
So we know, for example, as I said, I believe that the Venezuelan government is funding these efforts to import gangs, to import drugs, they're being paid for it. They're being helped with it. They're undertaking narco. They have a narco economy, and they are working to destabilize the northern part of Latin America. They're getting ready to invade Guyana, for example, and held a national referendum.
How can these guys even think about doing something like that when the place is a bleep hole and there's no money, there's no anything?
You can ask Russia.
Yeah,
how they can afford to invade Ukraine when their own economy is a disaster. In any event, we know this is going on. At this point, it becomes now a matter of international politics. It's not a law enforcement issue. We can't put the Chicago PD on the ground in Caracas or Bogota to deal with this. We can't make arrests. We can't interdict there. Our options are to do it on the high seas or to do it at the border. We're not a police state, at least not yet. So our options on doing this are limited with law enforcement. And so we have sent the word out. We're gonna start using our military forces to deal with this, because this is an international piracy, international terrorism, international operation that is working to destabilize us, and it's a national defense issue now.
I never once defended these guys, just by the way.
Oh, I know, yeah. I know. But the precedent for this obviously was set. I mean, it's been set in several places, but definitely set in the Middle East over the last 30 years in terms of how we've dealt with people who were state-sponsored actors who were not, quote, in uniform and not part of a foreign military, but were state-sponsored actors that were attacking American interests over there, and in some cases attacking American interests here. So the thought process is we could interdict, but the Coast Guard is really not set up for that. They have military capability and armed force capability, but it's limited. And so we have an establishment that can interdict. And the goal is right now to send the word to the people that are doing the trafficking that you're not looking at being arrested and put in a jail, where, by the way, your living conditions are likely to be better than the living conditions you left in Latin America. We're not going to do that anymore, because that's not working. That doesn't deter you. We're going to deter you now by killing you, by using armed force.
I would say this is absolutely not my style. I would do, first of all, if I'm president, I want to be able to show people some evidence, not just my word. And secondly, I would much rather see them land here and get the people in this end who they're giving it to.
Well, and that's part of it as well. But that doesn't work. I would like to see us do that as well. I would love to see us we can just make this a law enforcement problem, and our law enforcement is so efficacious that it can pick up all these other folks. But that hasn't worked. So we're looking at drug deaths. You know,
I'm with you on that. Plus, but why are we saying it's fentanyl and it's cocaine?
This is one aspect of the problem that we can solve.
So the fact that
fentanyl comes in a different way doesn't mean we can't shut down this.
I know,
this
but,
part,
but don't say it's fentanyl when it's not. I just can't lie.
I haven't heard anybody say it's fentanyl.
Oh, it's been fentanyl day one.
I haven't heard him saying these boats are full of fentanyl.
Oh, sure he has.
Have you?
Yeah.
Who has? I mean, who said that? Well,
the justification was this many people are dying from fentanyl overdoses, therefore we're shooting the boats.
No. What I've heard this many people are dying of drug overdoses. We're going to interdict this part of that drug trade.
The term fentanyl keep. Either way, look. Here's my concern on this mess, is that I always look for the, and you know you slap me around on this most a lot of times.
I would love to see I'm telling you the evidence is there, or they wouldn't be doing it. If they were doing it without evidence.
Oh no, I'm sure it's all kinds of cocaine. You know, it's not like they're doing nothing. I'm with you on that. But here's my concern is whenever something like this happens, it's sort of like you know, bitching at the drugs being made in India and putting a tariff on that. Okay, the penicillin shot is showing up here at a buck a shot. Okay, so you put a 50% tariff on it. Well, that's 50 cents. By the time it gets in, you're behind at Northwestern. It's $200 a shot. All the money's being made here. And this cocaine's been around. When I went to the trading floor, they had a cocaine bust the year before on the trading floor. This is a 50-year problem, for God's sake. The money is all made on this end.
And so I understand, and I suspect that there's going to be some drug enforcement at that level locally. But the short answer is that the enforcement at the with the people you're talking about is at a state level. And let's just point to our friends in Chicago who are not interested in arresting drug dealers or drug sellers, because we put the wrong kind of people in jail.
I'm not so sure they are all that not interested, but I mean this is a countrywide problem. They go from state to state, place to place.
Yeah.
And by the way, the cocaine is going up the nose of the richest kids in this country. We don't put them in jail either.
No, it's not. And by the way, again, that's a local enforcement issue. And we have proved over and over again that we're not willing to enforce it.
What do you suppose?
Local level.
I mean, I can give you a chapter and verse of the couple of ladies that I happen to know that were they're, you know, they have kids now. They're up. I'm not saying they're up in age, but their mothers. When they were in college, they were like pages on the Congress floor. The amount of cocaine that went down in Capitol Hill was astronomical.
I'm not going to argue with you. The local enforcement of this stuff, which you know, was not a federal issue. The local enforcement tended to be state issues, and
I'm thinking, Tom, if it doesn't work, Senate, it's not a local issue. If they want to stop it, they could have stopped it.
If it doesn't work, then you try something else, and we're trying something else.
Okay.
Am I comfortable having the military doing this stuff? I'm comfortable as long as we're not engaging in, quote, law enforcement, but are engaging in sort of an anti-terror international force kind of operation. That's legal.
I'm just trying to be economic about that. I'm not trying to be an ass, because you know I'm trying to...
I know you're not.
If there have been all kinds of rumors that the cocaine trade out of Afghanistan, once the CIA got hold of it, that the Taliban had actually cut it down and our guys made it better again. If you cut off Venezuela as a supplier and you don't stop anybody on this end, all you've done is raise the price and raise the profitability for everybody else.
Well, and so this, again, this is I think, a recognition of your principle, which is we are going to raise the price of running this stuff so that at some point the financial reward that you're getting is not going to be sufficient.
My point is it gets to be more because the price on this end goes up.
The price, and so at some point we're gonna say, okay, how much is it worth to you? Is it worth this amount of money? Is that worth your life?
Okay, my point is, we're blasting some Venezuelans who we don't care about when we could be taking care of the people here, and we're not.
I understand.
And it's not, you can't just blame it on the local, because
I do blame it.
Well, on okay, the locals. But if this is where. When we talk about federal local cooperation, I mean there's a reason why. Well, I don't see it anymore. I'm not young anymore, but there's a reason why 30 years ago every party you went to there was coke all over the place. I never had it. I never touched it. But matter of fact, Lou, I'll give you a funny story. I went to this party, and I had a job other than the trading floor, so I was a little older than everybody else was on the floor. And I'm going to use the term more mature. I think I was. But so I'm like 35. And I go to this party, and everybody's like 28. And you know, a couple of ladies there thought I was okay back in those days. I don't know. Maybe I was. But and so.
Well, you looked better with the cocaine.
So get a load of this. I'm at this apartment, and some guy puts out like five rows of cocaine. All right, and I'm sitting there going, hey, time. No, I don't do any of that stuff. So everybody gets out their $5 bills or whatever. Meanwhile, the golden retriever comes in from outside, all happy to see everybody. One swish of the tail, and the coke is now on the shag carpet. I'm dying laughing, right? And meanwhile, guys are like trying to snort the carpet.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I mean,
I'm like, I got to get out of this party. This is I was like the Three Dog Night. This is the party I shouldn't have gone to. I left.
That's right. Don't know what it is. I don't want to see no more.
But I mean,
on that note, the Golden Retriever story. We all shows. We should put a rule in. All shows have to end with a Golden Retriever story.
He was the happiest dog on earth. He didn't know what he did. Everybody's bitching at him.
All right. Just to you, FYI, the ski resorts opened the last weekend. So if you want to come out, come on out.
One final question about football. Our guys will be interested in this too, Wayne and Andrew. When you see these college coaches, we talked about the other day, and all Kevin and I did was say, where the hell's Lou when we need him?
You guys raise these issues when I'm not there.
Well, cause we're talking about the coaches, buyouts, of course, the guy at Penn State and now Kelly. And, and of course, the contracts have gotten a little more intelligent, because he had to take what he took half or something, and the guy from Penn State, he had to look for another job, and if he had another job, they had to subtract.
Anyway, yeah, there's an offset. Yeah.
But here's the weird part I'm getting, Lou, is these college boosters, for lack of a better term, if you become a 30 team, essentially NFL light league, you're going to try and get this quote, parity of some sort. Plus, you're not going to be able to play if Notre Dame's got or OSU or somebody's got a $100 billion payroll. You're not going to be able to play in any sense, Ball State or somebody 10 times a year, so everybody's 10-2. I mean, those other schools are going to say, we're not playing. Our guys are just going to. It's. I mean the Bears don't have an exhibition game against Slippery Rock, right? I mean, they don't. That doesn't happen. But. Somewhere along the line, these colleges, if you start playing all the other guys that are good too, everybody's record's going to be 8-4 or something like that, like they are in the pros.
That's why you need a closed league.
Well, because right now, the idea that you hire somebody, you pay him $80 million a year, or $8 million a year for 10 years, the first time he loses three games, you fire him, then you get another guy, $8 million. That's the most bizarre model I've ever seen. I mean, the Chiefs didn't fire Andy Reid because he had a bunch of guys hurt and lost three games in a row, or the guys in Baltimore didn't fire Harbaugh because the quarterback's out and he lost three games. You can't, every time you lose a game, you can't fire a guy in a 10-year contract. What's the matter with these people?
No, but that's the direction we're headed. And I expect within a few years, 5 years maybe, we are going to look at a 75 or 80 team super conference.
I think it's going to be less than that.
Series of four super conferences of 16 teams. Let's say four super conferences, 16 teams each, and those that's going to be your college football Division I.
You think that
that's where the playoffs are going to go?
I'll make you an over under on this. I don't think there's 64 colleges that want this massive undertaking of scouting, this budget. I mean, they're going to say how much they're making on this, but it's going to the expenses are going to increase to a certain amount. I don't see 60. I think the numbers will be more like 35.
No, but whatever it will be, and it will be funded with private equity.
But when are the Eastern Illinois is going to say we're not playing Indiana when they're paying people $100 million a year and we're paying people nothing?
It's going to take a lot because as long as you dangle the possibility of, hey, you could come join the club, as long as you dangle that possibility out there, people are going to bite on it.
But it's going to become uneven real fast, more uneven than it is.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Anyway, so
I've talked to my friends in the Service Academy business, and I said we are headed for Division II, boys, and there's nothing we can do.
But Division II is going to be a lot better than Division II used to be.
Could be.
You know, I was having a big Kevin and I talked about it yesterday. And my buddy last night, he's a big Marquette fan. I think the Big East is having problems with this. I don't think Marquette wants to be in the all-in NIL, paying everybody through the nose. And I don't think Villanova.
Nobody does. That's why private equity is going to come in and take this over, because they've got people who can manage it.
I don't think Marquette wants any part of private equity. Maybe the Big East will just play under themselves and go back to the old rules.
Could be. All right,
take care, buddy. Are you skiing? Are you skiing?
No. No, not anytime soon. All right, you guys take care out there.
All right, well, let's buzz into Andrew and Wayne. You guys with us?
Good morning.
How are you?
I am here too.
Sorry to run over a little bit, but as you know, my crazy fixation on the world is everything's the same subject. It's whatever you see. I mean, you know, Andrew, judge me on that. Is that? I don't think that's all that wrong. Is it? People are the same, no matter what walk of life they're in.
Well, I can say I love the Golden Retriever story, but also you have a comforting way of addressing horrible situations, and I'm talking now about bombing the actual boats and a lot of other things, including college football. I follow the University of Arkansas, and they had a $10 million contract that they had to deal with after three losses, and you think these are supposed to be universities.
Well, you know, we were talking actually yesterday, and what do you think? Take a guy like Brian Kelly, who I never liked, so that's, or Jimbo Fisher, or any of these guys that were, I'll use the term old school, meaning they were successful 10 years ago. This whole mess now is so different. I mean, I can't imagine. You know, first of all, I mean, Kevin excoriated me for the term film, but everybody's in this portal. Everybody wants money. Everybody wants a bid, essentially. And half of them, unless you recruited the kid out of high school, you don't know if he's any good. And all of a sudden, all you know, he hasn't played for Ohio State. He claims he'd be starting for anybody else, but how do you know? They're not going to send you practice video, or whatever you want to call it. I mean, and so all of a sudden, you give this kid a bid, and now he shows up. You start him, or if he's a quarterback, he's going to get money from Under Armour or somebody else, and they're paying him $1 million or $2 million to show up at wherever you are, Arkansas, Notre Dame. But now the coach says, this kid's not that good. You're playing a freshman ahead of him. Now, is Under Armour pissed off? Is somebody else? I mean, I can't imagine the different confluences of emotions going on in that locker room, where if I'm playing ahead of a guy who's making more than me. I mean, isn't that how SMU blew up years ago? They started telling on each other how much they all were getting, the wrong guys were getting paid or something? Wasn't that the end?
Yeah, and in a different context, I was just going through with a friend of mine how resentments were created when people who turned out to be really good in the pros first got their contracts. And I go all the way back to Frank Gifford, when he's football player. I used to play against him at the YMCA after he retired, but he got such a big contract that he wanted to quit football after his first year because the other players were so resentful that after he'd get tackled, they'd be punching him in the face at the bottom of the pileup, because they resented his contract.
Well, some of the girls are doing the same thing with Caitlin Clark.
Oh, that's that was actually part of the conversation. I was talking to a sports buddy, lawyer friend of mine, and we said, what is the matter with this NBA, WNBA? Two things. I used to cover this Boston Celtics in the NBA for a year, so it gives me an attitude, at least. I said, the box scores are totally, a high school newspaper would have better box scores with more information. But what's the matter with these refs? They won't call a foul.
Well, it's a
golden goose.
Well, I wanted to ask a little bit about how did you end up covering basketball games? Just you're a man about town. You're a man for all seasons.
Oh, kind of a funny story. Let me try to keep it to 38 seconds here. But I was a gym rat. I was playing down at the YMCA all the time. And in the summer of 1976, I was working covering news at the Hartford Current newspaper in Connecticut. And the sports editor is a pal of mine, says, look, the greatest player in the world is coming to Connecticut for a basketball camp, and nobody's seen him play because he plays in the ABA. Let's get him with a like George Plimpton thing against the worst player in the world. And I'm a little slow, so I said, what do you mean? He said, you're going to play Julius Erving, who's coming to the 76ers after winning the ABA championship for the Nets. So, he's an amazing, great guy. He agreed to play losers out against me. We got a big story out of it. And for those immersed in the financial world, losers out is kind of the suburban game where in one-on-one, if one guy scores, the other guy gets the ball instead of winners out, which is the urban game where, you know, he would have just made all 11 shots and that's it. So anyway, when the newspaper created an NBA beat, I was the only guy who'd done an NBA story. So.
Well, you know, he allegedly was a guy that nobody could beat in horse.
Well,
for those that don't know what horse is, you take a difficult shot, and if the other guy matches it, but evidently he could jump up behind the backboard and reach around, because he had the huge hands, and stuff it from behind the backboard. Nobody else could do that.
That may be an urban legend, because I follow that stuff fairly closely, and the conventional wisdom is that in addition to their other talents, Michael Jordan and Wilt Chamberlain had 48-inch vertical jumps, which were considered at the top. And with that leap, they could maybe barely get to the top of the backboard. But going over it,
I'm not talking about, I'm saying he could reach under it. It was all hand and ball control. It wasn't the height.
Oh, so you're not talking about going
over it? No. I'm saying he's going up behind it and being able to reach underneath it and have the hand control to stuff the ball down.
Oh, okay. Well, that's possible. But, you know, I hadn't heard that story, but he was an amazing talent and a really nice guy. And he actually, when I was covering the Sixers and Celtics years later, he remembered the story and it gave me my break there. And I draw on that year of sports coverage in a lot of ways, both and
well, I think you know, stories, a quick Frank Gifford story. Dr. J's dad, Dr. Najarian, who ended up becoming this famous transplant surgeon. He was on the cover of Newsweek and Time and stuff, and a really good guy, and I really liked him. We spent a lot of, he'd come here all the time. We'd spend a lot of time together. Just what a guy loved football. But he, talk about how old this is, guys. he was at Berkeley, and he was in med school, and he was a big guy, and he loved to play ball, and he was a pretty good tackle, evidently. And the coach said to him, "John, I know you're in med school. If you can make it to practice a couple days a week, that'd be great. We could sure use your help on Saturday." Could you imagine that today? I mean, the guy would be 100. He'd be 100 years old now, probably, maybe more. But I think he was a contemporary of Frank Gifford, and I think they knew each other. Gifford went to Southern Cal, right?
Yeah,
I believe. And when Gifford came out, he got the he wasn't a Heisman Trophy, but he was a big star. I think the number his dad told me was something like $7,500 a year. So what you're saying, he's getting beat up on the bottom of the pile. It wasn't for like $4 million. He was getting like $7,500.
Oh, absolutely. And he, for the younger members of your audience, and he'd have to be 80 to 85 to remember this, but Frank Gifford played, he not simply played defense, but he was an all-star on defense, and he was a punter and kicker. So the guy's playing literally the whole game.
Yeah.
He's making $7,500 a year. He's getting bashed in the face. And remember, a lot of people didn't even wear face guards,
right,
or most the single bar.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people could do some serious damage if they're punching.
Well, he said it to John's dad, and Dr. Najarian said, "I think I'll stay in med school for $7,500. I think I'll stay in med school." But those guys, I mean, you talk about football, and we're ranting off here, and poor Wayne sitting there, but they were, is, you look at the difference between, hey, the guys today are so much better, this and that. Well, first of all, the training and everything is different, but football really changed. Professional football changed, I'm going to say, in the 70s. And you're going to say, why the hell is that? Actually, probably, you probably already know. That's the time it became a full-time job. Before that, it was a part-time job. In the 60s, guys would go, Ed Obradovich was like a salesman during the year. And that's why your training camp was 6 games. Guys showed up at, you know, it took that long to get in shape to play football. There was no Hallis Hall in February. These guys had another job. Once it be, I think the Steeler teams, even though they couldn't play, you know, against a really good team, they were probably the first team, those Steeler teams were the first teams that were like a modern team. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and there's another factor of cable television, which really made the sports junkies happy and changed the economics. Because before then, you know, you'd follow your team, you know, mostly in the newspaper and local television. But if you lived more than, let's say, 50 miles from a strong broadcaster, you couldn't watch the games unless you actually went to them.
Well, the Bears, you couldn't get to home. The home games were not on TV. You had to go like to South Bend, or you had to go to a saloon at a big antenna.
Yeah. So, you know, in a way, it, you know, people were following it, but you didn't have all the ripple effects that lead to the big bucks for the players and owners. And
big bucks for guys like Wayne covering it. He's making $500,000 a year doing, sitting there before the game on the desk with all the other guys. Wayne, how come he never did that, sitting there with the four people talking about God knows what before the game, making a fortune?
Yeah, like, who was it? They tried Dennis Miller for Monday Night Football. I don't think that went over too well. I don't think he knew much about football, but he was supposed to be, I guess, some sort of comedian.
You'd have been the first. You'd have been a great replacement for Howard Cosell when he left.
Oh, I've got some. Having been in the press club now for 25 years, when I first joined, and I knew people who were in it years ago, but they had their favorite Howard Cosell stories because he was a member of the press club in Washington, and this is back when it's not that way now, but there'd be like four deep at the bar on any given night, and it was crowded. And people at the bar looked over by the door, and there was a little bench there, and there's Howard Cosell sitting there, and they started making fun of his toupee. And, you know, the more they razzed him on the toupee, the madder he got. But, you know, he was a good guy. He took it. And this was back when you could smoke cigars. And a lot of people did. And he just kept puffing on his cigar and took the razzing.
Wasn't he during the war, when I say the war, WW2, wasn't he at like age 25 in charge of all the landing craft manufacturing in New York Harbor with like 25,000 people under him or something?
It may be. It'd be an interesting story to look at. I'm actually getting ready to publish a book about all the, you know, they talk about Antifa, Anti-Fat, which is an acronym for anti-fascist. And you know, looking back at the, not only during the war, but in the 1930s, all the people who, you know, could qualify as Antifa, including all the guys that stormed the beach and D-Day, and I say guys, there also were women nurses that came in not long after the landing. So it was an all hands effort, and yeah, it's amazing what some people did. You look at the movie stars back then, who all most of them enlisted, yeah, rather than wait to be drafted.
You guys have a much more of a sense of history in this than me, but when you look at, and again, I love having guys on from different walks of life, because for some reason I get myself buried into this. Everything's numbers and economics, and you can sort of figure out people's behavior. And one of the books that I read that really opened my eyes a little bit, and I'm going to assure mine aren't open near as much as like Andrew loves to dig into this stuff. I was reading Arm & Hammer by Arm & Hammer, and you know, when I got to the Oxy stuff, I stopped. But the beginning part of the book is probably one of the most spectacular period pieces I've ever read of those times. And when we entered the Depression, I mean, the idea that everybody, you know, hung in there, they knew the American way, truth, justice, the American way, they knew our economic system was the best. Everybody just hung in there and ate bread if you could get it, and knew we were right. And it's total bullshit. I mean, evidently there are people all over the place that were looking at this brand of government ain't working so hot. I'm not saying they were revolutionaries. I'm not saying they were running around with guns shooting people. They weren't, but the curiosity was there. By the way, is the communist system better? Not that we want to be communists, or is the so Arm & Hammer's dad went to like a meeting of communists. He just sort of as a curiosity, and there were a bunch of, they didn't call them fascists. What do they call the guys here? The German, the Bund, or whatever the hell they were.
Oh yeah, the German American Bund in the 30s. Yeah,
because they had the biggest thing at Madison Square. It was sort of more of a curiosity, and now people, now today, I mean, I'm looking at the economic numbers, and you look at our system, what's happening here, and you have people that would say, well, this is a capitalist system. Bull bleep. Whatever we're doing now, we're becoming a plutocracy, and we're going to end up with 100 people owning the whole damn place, and the rest of the people not being able to get medical care or not being able to feed themselves. If we don't do something that makes some sense, and I'm not saying I'm not saying social, I'm not saying anything like that, but the idea that because it's working for you, it's working for everybody. Well, that's a pretty egotistical way to look at the world. I mean, I choose not to. So right now, everybody who looks at our system saying, what are we doing here? What are we, Antifa? We're this, we're that, we're socialists? No, we're not. We're just curious, I think.
You know, yeah, you know, there's several organizations do metrics on various countries, quality of life, democracy. And the United States has fallen to, like, I think we're in 28th place.
Yeah,
you look at the top of the list, and they're all the Nordic countries that have basically social democratic systems. Top of the list is Denmark, followed by Finland, then Sweden, then Norway, then Iceland, and then you get to like New Zealand, and Canada's way up there too, and we're like at 28. I mean,
well, we had one of the contributors was give me some grief about saying something about Sweden, where it seems to work for them. Everybody ought to know by now that if a guy who comes off the trading floor for 20 years, I don't want to say anything like socialism, but I wanted fair competition, which is not what we have. This is crony competition. But I mean, so somebody said, well, no, nobody works in Sweden. 79% of the people in Sweden work. Here, 58% work. What are we talking about? We're not even close.
And if Sweden's a socialist country, some of their companies, IKEA, Saab, Volvo, are doing pretty well.
You know, but it is, I went for a wedding in Denmark. It is kind of weird. I mean, if you're when you sell a business, the profit, it's like, what, 80% tax or something? 85?
Yes, that's how they pay for that social welfare program. It's basically they take the tax off the top. So instead of, you're already, you could be a multimillionaire and you're never going to see that money that's going, you know, that money goes directly to the government. And, you know, I don't think there's much in the way of, I'm going to itemize deductions. They don't have that.
Is there anybody? I mean, I'm not exactly Marco Polo. I'm more of a local boy. Does anybody have a more screwed up? A few weeks ago, I wish you guys had been there. Guy had some money. Was ranting and raving about how many people don't pay income tax. And I said, well, you know, we've got to be the only people. Now, of course, the guy, other than his opinion, he knew nothing. I said, you do realize we have like a four or five legged. Probably more like a four-legged tax thing here, and like nobody else has that, which I'm not so sure nobody does, but I think nobody probably does. He goes, what are you talking about? And I said, well, you've got income tax, and I actually had just done it the day before for the show, so I rattled off this. I said, you know, income tax, we get X number of $1 trillion. And then there's, you know, employment tax, which everybody pays, and it's very, if you want to call it regressive, it's regressive. I said, if you pay a guy $1,000 last year for shoveling your snow and you turn in the 1099, he owes $150. The guy goes, no, he doesn't. I go, yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. Because if you're self-employed, 15% is your Medicare and your, what is it, unemployment, whatever the other one is. Yeah, Medicare and Social Security and unemployment tax. I said, no, he goes, well, that can't be right. I go, yeah, it is. And I said, well, by the way, you also pay state and local taxes, which actually are more than the federal tax. And nobody gets away with that. Everybody, I don't care how much you make. If you're not paying income tax, you live in a house, you're still paying property tax, you're still paying sales tax. You buy a car, you're still paying sales tax. I mean, you buy a bottle of booze, you're paying. Where do you think nobody pays any taxes?
Yeah. I mean, we're paying basically a goods tax with the Trump's tariffs. Yeah. So you got five levels, I guess, now.
Well, where do you guys think? I was listening on the way in this morning. Evidently, people are presenting their arguments. Is it the Supreme Court where some groups are saying, hey, guys, all this is a tax and this emergency bill that does not come anywhere close to saying this kind of a tax that should go through the House of Representatives, it has to. And then the other side is saying everything's in. How do you think that comes out? Does he win this?
I don't know, but, you know, they say that Trump was very upset at the ad that the government of Ontario ran during the series highlighting Reagan. You remember Reagan used to do these Saturday morning radio chats, and that Trump said it was a fake. They faked it, but it wasn't. It was on, I believe, it was August 28, 1987, but they say the real reason Trump was upset is because of this case that's before the Supreme Court, and he thinks that Canada was trying to influence the Supreme Court here by running that ad. Now,
let me ask you, Wayne, when why the Democratic Party? I can't even the name when I used to be. I can't even believe their lack of balls and their lack of intelligence. This thing. Was by the way, I heard that. I remember it when Reagan gave that speech.
Yeah.
For those that don't know, he's sitting there in a flannel shirt. Now, Reagan would not go into the Oval Office without a suit on.
That's right.
So he's in his flannel shirt because it's coming from Camp David. And he's talking about having to put what was an emergency tariff on Japan, and it was like 10% or something like that. And all he did was apologize, basically, and say, I'm doing this because Japan is doing this nefarious deed, and I'm going to try and talk to him next week, and if we're successful, I'm pulling this thing right back, because I essentially hate tariffs. He went through the Smoot-Hawley tariff. He went through how the Depression, how it buried other countries, including us, and tariffs were the worst thing in the world, and free trade was way better for everybody, and blah, 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 because that's what he really believed. And it's probably a, what would you guess, four-minute speech, four and a half, five, something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah.
So, in his ad, the province of Ontario essentially takes what they consider to be the good parts out of there. And, of course, Trump starts bleating back and forth about how they took it out of context. And the Reagan Library said, yes, they took it out of context because they didn't play the whole thing. But there's no way you could miss the message. So my question is, if this is the big bitch, why doesn't somebody who either doesn't like Trump or the Democratic Party pony up a few shekels and play the whole thing in the middle of the World Series or in the middle of the Super Bowl? We've been accused of taking this out of context. Here's the whole thing. Judge for yourself. Yeah. Why don't we just do that? I mean, this is so simple, yet we don't do it.
Here's why I think doing what you say costs money. I mean, and the Democratic Party, the committees, they don't have that much money, and to buy a World Series ad or something like that, it's expensive. I think.
But I mean, however you did it, I mean, I'm saying, in today's world, put the whole thing out there on your X or whatever the hell you're doing it. Maybe it doesn't have to be a World Series ad. Just put it out there.
Well, again, not to be disputatious unduly here, but one of the little hobbies I have is looking at important things that people try to get in the quote media unquote, and sometimes they labor for, they do everything that you could possibly imagine, and it might take months or never. It's not easy to create a big story without just spending vast amounts of money.
Well, let me ask you this, though. When I remembered hearing it. I heard the little piece that was in the radio ad, then his hue and cry about they took it out of context. I click up YouTube. It's on the top line, the whole speech. So I said, boy, it's been since 1987 I've heard this. I click on it and I listened again. Why doesn't the 40% of the population that cares, it's right there.
I agree with you. But let me give one other example that you've raised previously, and I know you're coming up with breaks, so I'll be quick. But you said, why don't the Democrats just show up at Congress and show that they're ready to work? Well, actually, they have. And they've got photos of them there. And I spent part of this last week up on Capitol Hill at Congress. And, they're there on their side of the aisle, but it's just not publicized because publicity, news coverage costs money.
In this world that I'm not so sure, maybe when it's our turn to get off, we're happy to get off, I don't know. But in this world, it's not what you do, it's how it's perceived and how it's seen. If you show up and nobody takes your picture, what's the point? You might as well stay home.
They've got the pictures.
But I'm saying,
out.
You have to do it in such a way where they get out. Now, Trump is a genius at that. That's why they're losing.
Agreed.
I mean, duh. Right? I mean, you have to, I mean, it's, remember, you remember the movie, the hell's the name of it? It was George Pappard. It was the World War One flying movie. What's her name? Ursula Andress was in it, which was, of course, a good part. Where they were the German guys in World War One, and they were, you know, fighting against the Allies, obviously. And they've got these old if ever you want to see those old planes in the air, it's an absolute must see. What the hell's the name of the thing? But they, when it got on the ground, it wasn't so good. But this guy was he was a Trump-like guy. He came from the infantry. He did stuff in spectacular ways, even though he wasn't the best pilot. The guy who was the lieutenant or whatever was the best pilot, but nobody knew about the guy. So they told this guy his first kill, and he was just a narcissist, just like Trump. He gets his first kill, and he comes in and he says, "All right, I got my first kill." Because when you get 25 or something, you got the big oak leaf cluster. And they go, "Well, nobody saw it. It's not confirmed." And he goes, "But I killed a guy. Doesn't matter. It's not confirmed." So the next time, he gets the guy, he wounds the hell out of him in his plane, and brings him back to the German airfield. And when the guy goes to land, he shoots the hell out of the guy and crashes the guy right on the airfield. And he goes, "Now is that confirmed?" And of course, they're appalled because the guy was trying to land and he was wounded and the guy kills him. But the newspapers pick it up and he immediately is the star of the armed forces. It's not what you do, it's how you do it, guys. I mean, right?
That's right.
Well, anyway, S&P Futures down 17, NASDAQ Futures 93. Go through this in a little bit of detail because we've got Meta down 71. That's almost 10%. We got Google up 22, Microsoft down 11. Those were all earnings last night. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jacks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Ricky on the board. S&P Futures down 19. NASDAQ Futures down 100. We've been up huge. Individual stocks, like I said, Google's up 22. It's 8%. We've got Meta down 71. It's 9.5%. Microsoft down 11. It's down 2%. It was down like 16 last night, but it's come back some. Those are your big movers there. I mean, it's affecting the Dow, obviously, because Microsoft is in the Dow. Yesterday, the Dow was way up because Caterpillar is to the moon. Caterpillar was 582. It started the year in the 300s. I don't know what the story is there, but they claim now they're doing some stuff that has to do with AI or something. I don't know how that's working out, but somehow anybody's got that name in there. Now, if Andrew and Wayne somehow were become AI reporters, all of a sudden they'd be huge too. DAX up 33.1%. FTSE up, I'm sorry, down 33.1%. FTSE down 62.6. CAC around down 68.8. We've got bonds. We had the Fed announcement yesterday. We went up down a quarter point. The interesting part is the 10-year and the 30-year are exact same place they were before the two cuts. So I've been warning all along, just because the Fed controls the short term doesn't mean they control the long term. And if they keep cutting and put more money in the system, inflation goes up. You're going to find the 30-year and 10-year go flying up even though the other stuff's down. So be careful of that. We haven't seen it in decades, but it could be there. Nikkei up 17, call that flat. Hang Seng down 63.2%. Shanghai down 29.7%. So the only real movement there is Shanghai. Oil down 40 cents, 60.08. Well, the new middle now seems to be 60, and that's 63. That can't be good if you have oil. Brent down 49 cents, 64.43. Gold is trying to limp back here, but not so much today. Back under 4,000, 39.90. Down 10 bucks. Silver down 5 cents, 47.86. Foreign exchange. Dollar's kind of about the same, 115.73. Actually, dollar's a little stronger. The euro's down. It was over 117 a couple weeks ago, so that's a 1.5% move. Big moves in currency when you start doing that. British pound, 131. It was at 135, as you recall, maybe 3 weeks ago. Crypto, down 1,700, 108.931. 108 seems to be the spot we bounce off here. We'll see if it does again. Ricky, we got for us traffic, weather, sports. What, Toronto? And we have to ask Wayne and Andrew, Toronto wins, is Trump going to invite him to the White House?
Good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:39 here in Chicago, 47 degrees right now with a high of 55, breezy with times of clouds and sun today. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low of 44 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 63 right now with a high of 90 degrees, very warm with plenty of sun. Tonight, clear with a low of 61 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Emma Kennedy from Monroe's, we're looking at 27 minutes. Edens from Lane Cook, 40 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 42 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th, 30 minutes. And lastly, Stevenson from 29. 24 to the Dan Ryan 47 minutes. Let's talk MLB real quick. Blue Jays steal the series lead from Dodgers yesterday with a 6-1. Series is now 3-2 in favor of Toronto, and Game 6 is tomorrow at 8 p.m. Bulls beat Kings 126-113 yesterday, and Grizzlies beat Suns 114-113. Today we have Ravens at Dolphins at 8:15 p.m. and this Sunday, November 2nd, we have Bears at Bengals at 1 p.m. and Monday, November 3rd, Cardinals at Cowboys at 8:15 p.m. Back to you guys.
Guys, out of all the stuff I listed, what do you want to talk about? Except, what do you think about NVIDIA? $5 trillion. I mean, the money pouring in here. We're the Fed saying they're not going to run things off the balance sheet anymore, which is crazy. How are they going to fight the rise in the money supply from other places, like stocks going up? What do you make of all that yesterday? And then whatever you guys want to talk about, and Wayne, you got to talk about the dirt story, the dirt from the East Wing.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Well, the dirt from the East Wing and the Trump's new golf
course.
Oh.
Yes, well, they've got the East Potomac golf course at Haynes Point, and it's a public golf course. The land is owned by the National Park Service, but it's leased out to a nonprofit that runs this golf course. And now Trump is wanting to put his name on it as the Trump National Golf Course. I fear that he's going to basically take it over, privatize it. It's right there where the Potomac and Anacostia rivers converge. And I mean, it's a nice area of D.C. And he took some of the soil from what used to be the East Wing, and he's moved it down to this public golf course, or soon to be a former public golf course, I guess he's using it for building up the course itself. It's pretty flat, so he's probably putting some sort of artificial hills in there. But this isn't really being reported either. And the other problem is he just fired all six members of the Commission on the Fine Arts, which basically that's the group he should have gone to about this, what he was doing to the White House. But with him firing the members and putting his own cronies on that commission, you know, anything now in D.C. is fair game. He could tear down the FDR memorial. You know, he and his father despised FDR because of the New Deal. He could tear down the Martin Luther King Jr. memorial because, essentially Trump's a racist, and so was his father. And the older Trump gets, the more he starts to channel the old man, old Fred. Fred was terrible.
The grandfather got kicked out of Germany because he was a draft dodger. Boy, that apple doesn't fall
right
far from a tree.
That's right. He came to North America, the United States and Canada, merely to make money on the gold rush. And when he went back, they said, sorry, you can't have your German citizenship because you you avoided the draft. And he came back. He was a very, very reluctant American. He didn't want to be here. He didn't want to live here. He wanted to go back to Germany with his German family, and they said, "Nick's."
Well, he took off to escape the military service. Then when he went back, he thought it would be okay, and they said, "No, you're out."
That's right. And one of the things he made money on over in British Columbia was him and this other guy ran a bordello.
Yeah, well, he was. They kicked him out for what? More bad moral. Moral habits and
bad moral turpitude.
Yes. God. Well, with all these different, I mean, Andrew, is anybody able to follow the what's going on in all these courts? I haven't seen a picture of a lady judge here who's all over this guy from the ICE, not wearing the, because they have pictures of him throwing tear gas and stuff after she told him they can't use tear gas. And so now she's demanding him to show up every day and to get a body cam by, like, Friday, or else say why he can't. And she wants him every day to report on the stuff that he did, whether it was against her ruling. So now all of a sudden, the appeals court overrules her. Is this the biggest circus you've ever seen, or what?
Well, there's a lot of them going on around the country. And in fact, and I don't get into it on the show that much because it's not the economic and sports focus, but the main thing that I do is try to follow this stuff. So, for example, I'm covering the case, actually going to the courthouse, of the Trump prosecution of former FBI Director James Comey, and I also follow the cases like you're talking about. To answer your question, even I, who have been an attorney for 35 years and have covered the Justice Department at one point full-time, 5 years, there's so much of it that it's very hard to keep track of. And for the ordinary citizen, it's extremely hard because you have all these appeals, but it's important. And so to answer your question more precisely, there are some specialist blogs that go beyond even what I'm able to do by a lot. And one is Democracy Docket, run by an attorney. Another good one is called Empty Wheel by a non-lawyer, but she must have a photographic memory, but she's able to pull stuff together. And it's very hard. And then there's a whole host of kind of video bloggers who cover this, but it's very hard for the ordinary person to keep a synthesis of where things are and why it's important, but it is vital.
Are you following the thing in Portland? That seems like kind of a leader.
Oh, yeah. So, for example, just yesterday, an appeals court vacated the full appeals court that covers that area, the Ninth Circuit, vacated a ruling by two Trump-appointed judges that the two Trump-appointed judges said, well, Trump can do what he wants, and the full appeals court said, we're not ready to rule yet, but we're going to go back to the district judge who says, no, he can't do what he wants. Again, unless you're professionally involved, it's hard to keep track of, but every person listening to the show is a citizen who has a stake in this stuff.
Where is this going to come out? Is the rule of law going to win?
Well, we hope so. And what we've got to do is keep fighting. And I will, before the show is over, add a bit of inspiration, I hope. But, maybe I'll do it right now, if you don't mind. One, the tariff case before the Supreme Court that you mentioned earlier is totally vital, and we're going to know somewhat soon from the questioning whether the MAGA majority on the Supreme Court is willing to interpret the plain language of the law that it's Congress creates tariffs, not Trump. And we'll see. And they're going to be really conflicted on that because this is huge.
There are some emergency tariff stuff that power has been given to him. And a lot of people, not me, they had somebody was on maybe 3-4 weeks ago, if you guys listened to it. One of the ones, Meet the Press, or the other one that's on Sunday morning. And one of his stooges was on there. And the lady said to him, well, what constitutes an emergency? And the guy with a straight face said, whatever the president says is an emergency is an emergency.
That was the Treasury Secretary, Scott.
Yeah, I mean,
that was the Treasury Secretary.
And I'm thinking, there can't be a fourth grader that believes that.
Yeah, and Trump is his own worst enemy because this whole thing with Canada that ran the ad with Reagan shows it's not a national emergency. He just got ticked off. And so, you know, that will probably, they don't get that much time to argue before the Supreme Court. But if they're able to work that in, that totally contradicts the national emergency part of this stuff.
Yeah, I look at this as what Trump is doing is he's subjecting people to what's known as collective punishment. If he doesn't like something, he doesn't care what the negative effects are going to be. So collective punishment is, you know, when he slaps an extra 10% on Canada, that's not only punishing Canadians, it's punishing people in this country.
I think punishing people here more than there.
Yeah, more here than there. And when he, you know, he says, well, nobody's getting SNAP benefits. That's collect because the Democrats won't be a rubber stamp along with the Republicans in Congress. That's a form of collective punishment. And saying, well, I'm going to withhold federal funds to blue states. That's another yet another form of collective punishment. But when you look at which regimes through recent history have engaged in collective punishment, it's not a great list. It's pretty sobering because you know the Germans did it, and you know the Israelis have done it on the West Bank and in Gaza, and it's a list I wouldn't want to be on.
I would never have believed this of the Israelis 20 years ago. I would never.
No, that was it was different. Yeah, you know, you look back at the original governments. We talked about social democrats. They were all social democrats back then. You know, the Arabs had their issues with Israel, but there were also when they had Foreign Minister Abba Ibn. I don't know if you remember him.
I remember the name. Well,
yeah, and you know, he had a lot of secret meetings with Arab leaders because he was considered kind of like a very intelligent person, and they could deal with him. But nobody could deal with this gang over there now.
Let me ask you, dudes, a question I've been dying to ask you all week, and I always wait till the end, even though we're not at the end yet. I was mentioning, I think it was Kevin was on yesterday, and it was either Kevin or, I don't know, might have been on Tuesday, might have been Hal. When, you ever hear of Judge Toulmin here in Chicago? Did you ever hear that name?
He was the guy, I have not.
Well, he's the one who, you know, he was the guy who put Jeff Fort in jail, and he was on the appeals court, and he wrote a bunch of, actually, appeals stuff. One of the things he wrote, Andrew, was I think it's still around. He wrote an opinion regarding double jeopardy, where there was a mafia guy here who essentially rigged the jury, and then they brought him back for trial and they got him the second time, and so Toulmin wrote a kind of a famous thing from the appeals court was it wasn't double jeopardy, but because he had rigged the jury, he was never in jeopardy. Which kind of astounded a lot of people in the legal world, but it held up. And I don't know if you ever heard of that opinion.
He said, I'll look for it.
He said there was no jeopardy because he rigged the jury. So how could it be double jeopardy? This is the first time he was in jeopardy. He wasn't in jeopardy the first time, which you know I think kind of stunned a lot of people because there was a trial. Anyway, when he died, Bill Murphy, I actually had a beer with Bill last night. And I go, did you write that speech down? And he goes, no, I just wrote from the heart. Well, I remember being at the funeral and Bill saying, I wish I had, he had written it down. Bill's a very articulate guy. He says, you know, he said, Mike Toulmin loved the law because the more he got into it, here was a guy who was he got booted out of Nutrier because he stole the security guard's car and went for a joyride. So he decided he's out and he joined the Marines. Then he came back and went to law school and everything. But he became a guy who just absolutely loved the law. And Bill says the more he got into it, the more he realized that the law is the difference between us and animals, us and societies that have no law, where people, your strongest just wins. He goes, the law is what we have as a society that started, you know, somewhere in maybe with the church or somewhere in Britain or someplace. He goes, without it, we're nothing. We're just a bunch of animals. And I don't think, given the fact that mean, me and my experience in our business, every time something happens where you think the law is there to help you, they're not there. It's so easy to get so, you know, Congress, they're all a bunch of guys trading ahead of people. They're all a bunch of crooks. They're all this, you know, these guys are all on the take. It's the law, what makes us different, seems to me to be getting thrown out like the baby with the bathwater. I hope it doesn't get thrown out totally. Now, this maybe is a wake-up call. I don't know. Maybe so many people are so sour that we end up as the plutocracy and we never come back. I mean, I don't know where it's going to land. Do you guys have an opinion?
Well, let me hop in on that. I agree with the sentiment that without the law, we're nothing. Even eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth was considered a reform, because before that guidance, it was whatever the king or ruler wanted. So, you know, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth sounds kind of rough, but it's better than the alternative.
Better than killing you for an eye.
Yeah, right. Or for no reason. Here's the segue, which I hope is logical, that I wanted to stick in. And I think it goes to your point. For the last week, I've spent a lot of time with people from Ukraine, either Ukrainian Americans or directly from Ukraine, and about 1,000 of them have come to Washington for meetings, to go to Congress, for advocacy, to basically support democracy and freedom in Ukraine. And my brother and sister-in-law came down from Alaska for this, and we're not even have a background of Ukraine or anywhere close to there except Germany. And it's very inspirational. And last night, to kind of wind this up, after a whole week of going to Congress and meeting people and seeing these passionate advocates who just refuse to give up their freedom. The last part was a movie, and it's by a Ukrainian director. I think the title was For the Children, and it was, I'm almost going to choke up now, it was portrayals of children who had been blown up, kidnapped, and some of them got out of the hands of the Russians. You got double amputees who want to continue being, you know, child ballerinas with prosthetics. You've got one young man who wants to be a diplomat. And I'm getting close to choking up here, but just the courage of people who will not give up,
well, there's
freedom to the dictators.
I don't know if you guys ever came on when Angelica was our, now that she lives too far away to be our host, but she was our board person. She was terrific. Showed me pictures of her school in the hospital where she was born, or just all rubble. And a lot of people she went to school with, they're messed up.
They were targeting apartment buildings, a maternity hospital, and the director was there, and I just wanted to thank him. But he talked about how do you make a movie like this, and one of the interesting questions was, he said, well, we want everyone in America to see this, but the big studios, they're thinking, well, it's too grim. Even though we took out the blood, we used animation for some of the worst stuff. And whenever we talked to one of these children, we had a psychiatrist there so that we don't trigger them. But
God, how would you like to be that psychiatrist? Who's trained to do that?
Well, they're there, and they some of the children were talking about how wonderful it was that they, after they escaped or in their rehabilitation, and I mean, this one kid, I mean, he had 40% burns, and he's totally disfigured. He's about 10 years old, and they showed him in ballroom dancing competitions
Wow.
with regular kids, and you think, good God.
Well, what is the, without getting into the politics of it, the yeah. amount of damage, I was reading some stuff about Gaza, 60% of the people there have a family member who's dead. They're leading the world in amputees and kids and stuff. You know, whatever the, you know, I'm not a, no fan of Hamas or anything like that, but the carnage is just, is how does anybody even, the other night they knocked off 100 people because one Israeli soldier got killed or something, I don't know, but all of a sudden they, you got a ceasefire and there's airstrikes, and then, okay, we're back into a, how do you have airstrikes during a ceasefire? I mean, what is everybody going crazy in this world or what?
Well, we going back to what Wayne's writing about the World War II and World War I era, we've got to rekindle this sense in the country of that this is not just stuff that we shrug our shoulders at. We've got to get involved and.
Well, yesterday Trump said he's going to start testing nuclear weapons again. So, I'm not hopeful.
Well, we're a little bit out of time, but I got to ask you this question: as if there wasn't enough variables when you manage people's money in the market to start with. It's always been a tough game, and that's why essentially people hire me to do it because that's what I do all day. But this new variable of picking the 10 stocks that the government is liable to pick and invest in, and they're going to go up 50% versus the rest of the market going the other way. I don't think I've ever been dealt a variable quite like this. What is this going to be the new way where we anoint a company like NVIDIA or somebody is the number one, they spent $5 trillion yesterday, and either the government or them starts buying pieces of other companies, they go up 25-30%, and all the rest of the companies in that group go shuttering down. Is this, and I'm absolutely convinced, nobody can convince me otherwise, that we have some of the nastiest players we've ever seen in this world sitting in the White House or someplace front-running all these stories. This is something that, I mean, let's put it this way, I think people need me more than ever, because some one of these days, either this is going to be all there is and there's 20 companies left or 30 companies, or we're going to go the other way and they're going to come flying back down. I know you guys have a chance to look at this, but what do you make of this from my end?
Well, I think you've got a very, I've thought about this a lot, you've got a very valuable role, because in some way you're going against conventional wisdom by raising some of these issues when the stock market keeps going up. And yet,
It's narrower and narrower, Andrew. Narrower and narrower.
It can't last forever. And I was just reading the other day about how happy everybody was in the late 1920s. Every ticket has its price. Every boom has its bust. And people are getting on the show. I think a sense on the cheap of your experience, and in the same way, at this Ukrainian event, they had two immigration lawyers who were describing the really difficult situation that Ukrainians who came here as refugees or whatever, a maze of immigration problems. And somebody said, well, they talk too much. And I said, this audience is getting thousands upon thousands of dollars of immigration law wisdom desperately needed for free. Let them talk.
Well, last question, I promise. We got to go, and so do you. But what I'm trying to get to on this, Andrew and Wayne, I'd love your input. If you just took my years of experience and look at these companies like even NVIDIA, which is, you know, it continues to grow and so forth, and I look at Oracle and the prices, you know, Palantir, somebody, you look at some of the prices on these companies, you sit there and go, I'm not only not investing, I'm getting out, and by the way, I'm shorting them. Yet, if the chairman of Oracle's kid and Trump's kid are buddies, and all of a sudden Oracle's going to end up with TikTok, and they're going to be the anointed people of the federal government, I'm not sure any of my old stuff, I might want to buy the damn place. If they're actually going to be, it's just different, guys. And if all of a sudden, like I thought, who are the guys? Nokia. Nokia's a dud. All of a sudden, NVIDIA is going to give them how much money to buy NVIDIA stuff. And Nokia goes flying up yesterday. I mean, how would I know that? Well, I would never have put one of my people in Nokia out of the blue. Now I'm sitting there going, God, if I'd have got the memo, I'd have loved to put them in there. I mean, this is something I've never seen. I don't know if you guys are noticing this or not.
I say it's a state-run market economy, and welcome to the People's Republic of China. You know, most of the companies over there, they're either owned by or partly owned by high-ranking people in the Chinese Communist Party.
Was this the new Republican mantra, or is this Trump mantra? When he goes, it goes, or is this now the future?
Everybody's bought into it, so you have a hard time finding Republicans who object to it. But here's one last Ukrainian story. Adam Kinzinger, the congressman from just outside of Chicago, a Republican, he was a keynote speaker at this thing. And, you know, you find isolated Republicans like him who say this is not right, but they few and far between.
How much of a landslide off the sinking ship is going to be if this market ever goes down?
I don't want to think about it.
You got a guy in there because everybody thinks they love him. What if they don't? You know, a lot of people, I'll tell you what, a lot of Republicans I know think he went too far with this Reagan thing, because Reagan's held in higher esteem than Trump. He better figure that out.
Well, the very quick last thing here, but Wayne and I were talking about that Reagan thing, and Wayne's sending me other memes of Reagan distorted by artificial intelligence to say all kinds of kind of funny, goofy things blasting Trump. And Wayne and I had the brainstorm, maybe these memes with artificial intelligence are things that Trump and his people have seen, and that's why he got so upset.
Maybe.
Because he thought this one was fake, too.
Anyway, guys, we ran over a little bit, but it's always good. Nice to hear from you dudes. Always good stuff. Don't get any of that dirt dumped on you in that golf course if you're playing over there, Wayne.
Yeah, right.
S&P's down 30, Ned's after down 134. I can just imagine sitting there, a big dump truck comes by and putting it in there. I go, where the hell did that come? Well, that came from the East Wing. if you wrote this in a book, they'd commit you, for God's sake. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.